Nice to see faces, familiar and unfamiliar. Welcome, everybody. Thanks, Saul, for that introduction. Just a quick word before I begin, that as you can see from the screen, I have changed the title. It is not the title as advertised, but that just represents the work I've done since I gave the original title. This is a fine-tuning of the ideas as proposed originally, and you'll see how they've developed as the lecture unfolds. So I'm just going to jump straight in. There are three sections to it. Section number one, performance in the mix. Mark White, sometime member of post-punk band The Mekons, recently recounted a compelling account of the predicament of young artists in the mid-1970s. There was a very disputatious mix at the time, he recalls. Quote, a lot of arguing, a lot of discussion, a lot of thought about the world we found ourselves in. And from that came a search for form. You know, this is the world we're in, we're not very happy about it. How do we start representing that unhappiness? Is it through visual art? Is it through performance? What is it through? And that's really where we found ourselves in what would be 75, 76. We were in this world in which political consensus was breaking down. Really, I suppose, what you saw was the death of modernism. If you think of something like the bulldozing of Quarry Hill Flats as being an emblem of social cohesiveness and modernist architecture of progression, all that was collapsing while we were there. It's an extraordinary image of how social, political progressiveness died. And also the fact, as everybody in Leeds pointed out to you, that was where Hitler was going to put his bunker if he moved. Unquote. There is rather a lot in this fascinating, capacious quotation. Rather more, in fact, than I can really do justice to in the time I have this evening. But I want to begin with it nevertheless because it vividly telegraphs a key aspect of my subject tonight, namely, how did a perception of the failures of progressivist culture inform or even drive experimental arts practice in the West in the 1970s? And what happens to our understanding of art, of music, and of performance if we see them as expressions of profound disillusionment, in this case, of a disenchantment with the art and politics of the so-called long 1960s. Can you hear me, by the way, if I move around? Yeah. For White, the son of two CND-committed left-leaning teachers in the south of England, a lot of the protests that had either gone before him or in which he had participated as a teenager seemed to have bore little fruit by the mid-70s because we were still, he recalls, in the nuclear age. The demolition of Quarry Hill Flats in 1978 stood for many, including for White, as further talisman of progressivist failure, and particularly of the politics of post-war social democracy and welfareism. By mid-70s, as you can see here, the flats had largely fallen into disrepair and were only half inhabited. All this despite the high hopes for social housing when they were built in the late 1930s. As a fresher fine arts student at the University of Leeds in 1975, White spent his first term living in Hunslet Grange, by this time another monument to the failure of modernist municipalism. Built only 7 years earlier in 1968, by 1975, its poor construction issues, its damp and cold problems were already evident, and it was therefore being rented to students on short-term lets. White goes on again. Hunslet Grange was a set of low-rise, deck-access flats on the Leeds Pontefract interchange. Hard to let, really foul. You could see through the crack in our wall. You could actually see the motorway interchange, that sort of thing. And it was, for a lad from the southeast, it was difficult. And then beginning to understand the rest of the city was shocking in a lot of ways, because it really was the end of something, very definitely in Leeds in that period. And you couldn't see what the beginning was going to be. It was run down, It was filthy, it was violent, it was virulently anti-Southerner, and politically to the right of Genghis Khan at all points. Though clearly not lacking in humour, White nevertheless vividly testifies to how the prematurely decaying architectural fabric of a northern English, soon-to-be post-industrial city suggested the problem and the worry about what was to come next. Politically speaking, where things were going was perhaps all too distressingly imaginable to White. With the right-wing National Front literally on the march in the city from the mid-70s onwards, the possibilities appeared far from benign. But the artistic way forward, on the other hand, seemed almost impossible to grasp. Because it really was the end of something, you couldn't see what the beginning was going to be. But then, sometime in late 1976 or early in 1977, it's difficult to be sure exactly when, White, along with fellow fine art students Andy Corrigan, Tom Greenhalgh and John King, made a stab at a beginning, despite the evident difficulty in being able to envisage one exactly. And the form of this beginning was as a performance. This is before, or just on the cusp of, the four of them becoming known as post-punk musicians: White, Corrigan and Greenhalgh for their membership of the Mekons, and King as lead singer of the Gang of Four. For those of you who are too young to know who these bands are, YouTube is your answer after the lecture. But a piece of performance art it was. Staged in the University of Leeds Student Union building, the event was announced over the tannoy as an expose of Marxist dialectics in the debating chamber. Only 20 pence, bar extension applied for. And this is how John King recalls it. The performance involved conversation and drinking, the second reducing the quality of the first. We dragged in a table and dressed it as our shitty dining table. Mark was outstanding. I can't praise enough his monologue about how people move from sweet to dry wines, as dreary as it sounds, but it was acute and strangely melancholic. We each talked about banal subjects until we ran out of steam and someone else took over. I think I talked about how the traffic is sometimes busy, but often not. The order of the day was to do something unremarkable, except in front of people, and not, so far as we could, act, and essentially to take up time without incident. There were other elements involved. In addition to the table and the beer bottles, which can be seen in this rare photograph, a photograph which unfortunately, as you can see, catches the glare from an original print now feared lost, there was a brass or iron bedstead, which is not pictured. Corrigan climbed out of this in order to join the others on their seats, presumably as if getting out of bed. Thereafter, the drinking and the possibly scripted, possibly improvised exchanges began. King, at least as we see him here, slumped on the right, appears to be reading from a script. There was also, likely at the beginning of the performance, a record played of Another Party with Victor Sylvester, a well-known LP in the 70s of anodyne British ballroom music. The piece lasted for around an hour, though some people recall it feeling a lot longer because of its slowness and the lengthy pauses between different elements, the final of which, clearly visible in the photograph at the top, is a projection screen. This was set up for a screening of a film made by King, Corrigan and fellow student Kevin Lysette, another soon-to-be Mekon. All three were involved in the University Film Society, which screened avant-garde and underground films, including the work of Andy Warhol, Michael Snow, Maya Deren, and Jean-Luc Godard. King & Co. had already created their own underground-type film, shot on a tea trolley along the Red Route in the modernist part of Leeds University's campus, then renowned for being the longest corridor in Europe. I don't know if it still is. The film was pretty good, according to King, since it successfully, and this is his words, occupied time without events, perhaps in a manner akin to Warhol's Empire or Snow's Wavelength. But was the performance so successful? King goes on to say, I'm quoting him, "Tom Greenhalgh passed out due to drink during the show, which was a shame as something actually happened, and hence, I guess, why he's not pictured here. The film ran, not many people came, it was a triumph." From this testimony, we could venture that for King at least, is likely tongue-in-cheek notwithstanding, it was a success, albeit a qualified one. The fact that it hardly generated an audience, some estimates put it at around 20 people, was proof positive, perhaps, of its virtue as an avant-gardist work, definitionally opposed, as the avant-garde is, to popular reach and popular appreciation. T.J. Clark, the social historian of art, who had been appointed fine art professor at the university only a matter of months earlier, was one of the 20. His characterization of the show at the time as, quote, "negotiating the aesthetics of tedium," unquote, seems gnomically to have avoided making any decisive judgment about it. Probably because he's new, right, and he wants to support these students and all the rest of it, so he doesn't want to dissuade them from their activities. But Corrigan's, Greenhalgh's and White's assessments, in contrast, seem much more definitively negative. In the interests of time, I'll share only White's testimony with you here. So we tried to create some form of performance art. We tried to put together something which we felt would be hard-hitting and incisive, powerful, and which had something to say about disillusion and nihilism and all the rest. And largely, I think it was incredibly long and astonishingly dull and had no great viability at all. And certainly at the end, we felt we'd reached a definite dead end and that wasn't the direction we needed to go, unquote. And with, I think, his tongue much more firmly planted in his cheek than John King's, he goes on, "Our attempt at performance art had all the incisiveness of Beckett and the power of Pinter, yet of course managed to successfully avoid both." This avoidance of theatre could of course have been viewed in an extremely positive light at the time this performance was realised. Performance art's rejection of theatrical convention was fundamental to its valorisation as radical form in the 1970s. Jeff Nuttall, member of the performance art group People Show and author, very famously, of Bomb Culture, regularly drew a distinction between performance works oriented towards theatre, which he identified as conventional in its dramatic and entertaining realisation of characters and plot, and performance art, which instead created unexpected juxtapositions of surprising elements in a live setting, usually to generate discomforting effects in the audience. In this case, it looks like a baby in a pram. In summing up the purpose of performance art, Nuttall was to write, "It is a program for restoring the public life appetite by challenging or destroying expectations." This kind of avant-gardist valorization of the form echoed through the great Hanger Studio and the purpose-built performance space at Leeds Polytechnic, where Nuttall taught throughout the 1970s, and which was renowned as one of the only places where one could study it in an academic setting in the UK at this time. A number of performance art groups emerged from the Polytechnic student body in the early 1970s, including Soft Soap, Hesitate and Demonstrate, and Didart, the latter becoming particularly famous in the mainstream press for their Arts Council-funded Circular Walk, which at least in a rudimentary way comprised three guys walking around East Anglia with a wooden plank strapped to their heads. But there was an emergent feeling, and one shared by Nuttall himself, that the unsettling energies of performance art were already beginning to dissipate as early as 1976. White, though studying at the university up the road, as it were, from Leeds Polytechnic, was of a similar mind, and this is White. Performance was beginning to run down, really, as a viable form, or one felt it was, by the mid to late 1970s, but it certainly still had something about it that was interesting and exciting. Unquote. The book I'm currently writing pores over contested readings of this moment, perceived by some as coming just after the high watermark of performance arts radicalism. It is a moment when performance arts value is perhaps especially in dispute, and when its experimental virtue comes to be seen by some to inhere in what working in performance might lead to, as if one needed to work one's way through it, rather than engage in it as a valorized form in and of itself. It is interesting in this context to speculate about why the soon-to-be Gang of Four and Mekons members opted to do a performance in the first place. In my estimation, the reasons were probably, first, that performance was something not taught, at least at Leeds University, or barely taught, as at the city's Polytechnic, where even though the material resources to make performances were in plentiful supply, as a veritable embarrassment of riches, and makers of performance works were numerous amongst the fine arts studio staff, there was a laissez-faire type of anti-pedagogy at large there. This entailed students, if you like, as a matter of pedagogic principle, being left largely to their own devices in producing their art. All of this meant that the making of performances seemed quite markedly exploratory, perhaps in ways that making a painting or a sculpture wasn't. It required students' faith in their own untested and unguided ideas and openness to what might happen in the performance process in order to carry the practice forward. Secondly, performance appeared to be more protean and somewhat undefined around its edges, which made it particularly conducive to expanded, transdisciplinary experiments with film, text, sound, and music, and thereby readily opened up what could be conceived as a viable artistic format at that time. Section 2, forming a band. This openness of performance art as a form is perhaps what makes it the gateway drug, if you will, to post-punk musicianship at this time. This was true in various ways for other Leeds fine art students who went on to be in music groups, some of whom went on to enjoy mainstream pop success, like Mark Armand and Dave Ball of Soft Cell, both of whom studied at the Poly, or those who garnered more alternative, independent recognition, like the late Marion, aka Kitty Lux, who was singer with Leeds bands Severed Head and the Neckfuckers, Sheeny and the Goys, and Really, and until recently was part of the Ukulele Orchestra of Great Britain. Armand and Ball collaborated on Weimar-esque avant-garde cabarets, where Armand's nihilistic scenarios would be rendered edgier by Ball's electroacoustic noodlings. And Lux was at first involved in body artwork involving varying degrees of nudity. Speaking perhaps for many members of his generation and referring directly to the debating chamber performance, Andy Corrigan recalls, quote, "We didn't find our feet as a group, as a music group, until we started doing those performance things. I suppose we were trying to see what we could get away with, see what was good. We were just messing about, really." And then punk hits Leeds in December 1976 in the shape of the Anarchy in the UK gig at Leeds Polytechnic. A further forum was readily suggested in which this messing about could be extended. Incidentally, in the Yorkshire Evening Post review of this gig, you can see a photograph here of the young Corrigan sporting a silvered razor blade bought specially for the occasion. The gig was a Road to Damascus moment for many people in Leeds who subsequently went on to form bands. Roz Allen, another fine art student and member of the founding 1977 lineup of the Mekons, usefully sums up the impact of punk and performance art taken together, as it were. I think what followed on from the punk thing was that anybody could get up and perform, and certainly going to the Poly and seeing Frank Tovey, who became Fad Gadget, Mark Arman doing performance pieces, there was some feeling that you could try anything. It was incredible. You didn't have to be able to play music or read music to perform, and I think that's quite crucial. And you didn't have to be a bloke. You know, there was a lovely mishmash of different cultures and disciplines coming together at that time. What I'm trying to say here is that this mishmash, as Alan puts it, this working at or across the edges of artistic disciplines, was driven by a generational drive to fathom a way of working that matched their expressive needs. It was not, or not simply, about fostering a kind of happy, permissive, disciplinary liberalism for its own sake. Mark White, again, it's meant to be blank. Mark White, again, is particularly lucid on this matter, and is why I lean on his testimony so heavily tonight. I think an awful lot of the flailing around we did was a search for form. What form is this disillusionment going to take? Quite how we ended up in bands, I'm not entirely sure. We were just flailing around trying to find some form that would represent or bear witness to disillusion. Certainly what the Mekons were doing was bearing witness to this, rather than necessarily trying to create a meaningful intervention. We never had that confidence that what we had to say would make any difference, but we knew we had to say it. Such a statement, involving flailing around and a lack of confidence in one's own ability to change things, hardly amounts to a normative thrusting construction of heterosexual masculinity, and is the reason why the Mekons have been frequently viewed as blasted and defeated, even gloriously so, by their most ardent and supportive fans and critics. Their first shambolic-sounding single for the Fast product label, Never Been in a Riot, is often taken as talisman of what we might call their givenness to lose. This song is usually read in comparison to The Clash's ferocious White Riot, in which Joe's drummer sings of his desire. You know this song? You know it? Again, YouTube is your friend. Joe's drummer sings in White Riot of his desire for a white riot in the wake of his experience of black street resistance to heavy-handed policing at the Notting Hill Carnival in 1976. The Mekons, by some contrast, sing, "I've never been in a riot, never been in a fight. I'm always in the toilet, missing out the noise, missing out the noise, missing out the noise." Here, the band exhibit their pathetic or deflated subjectivity, their seeming inability to rise to the call of history, or what John Langford has described in another register as their art school wimpiness. Such touting of purported failures of one kind or another has continued in recent years as the band have, somewhat miraculously perhaps, given their large and changing membership, celebrated their 30th birthday. When current member Sally Timms was asked by a radio host in the US to share the secret of the Mekons' success, her waggish answer was not to have any. But thinking two-dimensionally about failure blinds us to what I think is the Mekons' greatest positive achievement, namely sustaining an ongoing practical exploration of the dynamic possibilities of group creation. For this is the form, the social relational form of the band, which White and his compatriots ultimately arrive at. After painting, after performance art, even after punk, the creative form that comes to express their practice as artists is a peculiarly open iteration of the band structure. White explains one final time. Part of our disillusion was rooted in a deep distrust of the single white male authorial voice. That's part of the reason why there were two singers in the Mekons, not one. And also, the big thing about punk that people forget is that it wasn't just the band, it was everybody. There are a lot of people in the Mekons, deliberately. There are an awful lot of people working with us, and we were all the same. We were all of equal weight. Everybody got the same wage, which was nothing for a very long time. And also, we were the audience. Often there were more people on stage than there were in the audience, but we were all on the same level. There was no barrier. And this was very deliberate. So there wasn't a sense of an unequal balance of power, which is what we saw in the rest of the world. Such an avowed commitment to an open access, commons type construction of band identity was almost bound to fail, of course, particularly when designed to erase the dividing line between the band and its audience. This was so because at live gigs, audience members sometimes took to the stage and started strutting, pretending to be stars, and otherwise lording it over their would-be audiences. Such eager conscripts into the Mekons project thereby theatrically reinstalled the very band-slash-audience division that open participation was designed to eradicate. As Mary Harron astutely put it in Melody Maker in 1979, Mary Harron, the filmmaker, later to be a filmmaker, quote, "In the end, the Mekons are a lesson in contradictions, about trying to work without hierarchies, in a situation that imposes them, about trying to work from an ideological basis when rock music has a mindless passion and energy that blows theory apart," unquote. This way of working, a way of working with and through contradictions, would have already been familiar to the four undergraduates who made art out of a group performance, where art was habitually understood as an individualized product. Although the debating chamber performance might simply look like a bunch of lads drinking, it wasn't just that. It paved the way for a time when, after 1976, after punk, it became possible to expand this creative practice of negotiating contradictions by making avant-garde art in and as pop music. The Mekons communalist practice had many close correlatives in 1970s Leeds. The cooperative movement was strong in the city at this time. The Suma Health Food Co-op was established there in 1977, the same year as the Mekons and many other social enterprises and creative groups organized themselves according to non-hierarchical principles and forms of collective self-governance. This included Impact Theatre Cooperative, which incidentally shared a rehearsal building with Mekons of Gang of Four that was rented from Suma in Leeds city centre, small world. Impact devised remarkably maverick theatrical productions as a collective somewhat devoid of the usual hierarchies of a theatre company, and of clear-cut roles of director, writer, actor, set designer, etc. Their work was largely anti-narrative and formed instead an affecting assemblage of relations between text, images, performed gestures, elements of set and lighting, and often self-composed music. Even though not quite as open a band structure as the Mekons, i.e. the audience weren't invited to participate, the horizontal process and lively multiplicity that Impact employed in the production of their shows nevertheless resulted in an openness of aesthetic form, lying somewhere between filmic tableau, live images, avant-garde music, and theatre. As founding member Claire MacDonald has recalled, by the time Impact began to make their work in the late 1970s, quote, "Theatre had become a space of tribal self-education and self-medication in which we inoculated ourselves against the straight world and the irrational power of the forces of history." I love that. We inoculated ourselves against the straight world and the irrational power of the forces of history. Indeed, Impact Productions obsessively imagined worlds after fictive, apocalyptic, or real-world historical events, as if trying to work out over and over again what to do exactly once the certainties of previously existing modes of life are wiped out. I mention impact here not only to indicate how theatre was very far from the moribund, conventionalised practice that Jeff Nuttall presumed it to be at this time, but also to return us to the theme of endings and of history with which we began. Part 3, the last part. Disillusionment then and now. The young artists I have reflected upon throughout this lecture were substantively affected, as we have seen, by a perception that the social democratic governmental system that had ruled the UK since the Second World War was beginning to fall apart in the mid-1970s, whether as a result of global economic problems that impacted upon the nation, or as a result of the changing ideologies at play within the then governing British political parties. But this consciousness of the system's demise, above all brought about through the instigation of cuts to central and local government spending from 1974 onwards, did not have any demonstrable effect during those years at least on what now, looking back, appear as the halcyon days for British higher education students. Art school education, along with access to higher education more broadly, was fully state-funded in the UK from 1962 until 1985. All students, regardless of income and economic background, received a mandatory maintenance grant from their local education authority during this time to fund their studies. There were no fees to pay. All the artistic, musical and performative work I've spoken about this evening was helped to realisation, perhaps even made possible by state funding of one kind or another. Non-students involved in the Leeds scene at this time benefited directly from other state benefits and funding bodies. A lucky few had Arts Council funding, whilst others, barring the even unlikelier event of commercial success, had the dole. Though higher education maintenance grants became means-tested from 1985, the system I describe here was still largely in place in 1986 to allow myself and others like me from working class backgrounds to go on to higher education. Thankfully, it's a very poor quality scan of a photograph on my first day at Goldsmiths University of London in 1986 with a not especially subtle sartorial indication of my political commitments. So, the system of HE that I just described was still largely in place and allowed myself and others like me from working class backgrounds to go on to higher education in the late 80s without any hesitation about its affordability. There were no fees to pay. I received a full local authority maintenance grant. I claimed housing benefit to cover my rent and claimed the dole during the summer holidays. The fact that this system of support existed is without question what makes it possible for me to stand before you today delivering a professorial lecture. All of this contrasts starkly with the newly marketised English HE system, which we currently labour under, and the burdensome levels of debt heaped upon students since the introduction of high undergraduate fees in 2012. Of course, the new system of financing has been devised to pay for a vastly expanded rate of participation since the 70s and 80s. But, as Valerie Walkerdine perceptively puts it in her own take on these issues, quote, "One of the paradoxes of the current situation in Britain is that while there have never been more places in higher education, it has become more and more exclusive." Bearing witness to this very fact, a report published in 2016 by the Higher Education Policy Institute, perhaps somewhat surprisingly, identified disadvantaged white boys as the least likely class of person to go to a university today in the UK. the class I would likely have been positioned in by any comparable study back in the mid-1980s. It is for these reasons, then, that I'm writing the book on the Leeds art school scene. It is also because, as a graduate myself of Leeds University in the 1990s, sometime after the post-punk moment, I benefited enormously from the Marxist and feminist theory teaching there. It quite simply shaped my world. Initially, as I began the research for this book, I was excited to find similar stories to my own about the transformative impact of the exceptional and radical pedagogy at Leeds, before, as it were, my time there. I was hoping to find much about the role that the teaching of performance art at the Poly and broadly left theory at the university had played on the shaping of a somewhat overlooked avant-garde scene in West Yorkshire at the time, and how the impact of this was felt internationally, especially as a result of the cultural visibility of many Leeds music outfits. The book is still about all of these things. But in the wake of conducting over 60 oral history interviews in the course of my research, I have been struck over and over by how, for every interviewee that mirrors my own enthusiastic experience, there are probably at least five others that voice dissatisfaction, indifference, or outright hostility to the teaching that they did or did not receive in their student years. Upon graduating from Leeds Polytechnic, Scritti Politti members Green Gartside and Tom Morley even went to the lengths of penning and publishing a lengthy analysis of and venomous attack upon the liberal romanticism which they took to be at the bankrupt heart of fine art pedagogy at the Polytechnic. Jeff Nuttall is mentioned many, many times in this excoriating text. It was so excoriating, I think that's actually a quote from Nuttall, show us your uniqueness. It was so excoriating, personalised and presumably libelous that Studio International, after receiving legal advice, redacted huge parts of it, as can be seen there. To some degree, this was the worst NSS return that never was written. Sutapa Biswas, one of the very few non-white students attending Leeds art schools at this time, hooded her feminist art history lecturer, Griselda Pollock, in a performance at the University Fine Art Studios in 1984, designed to highlight the problematic blindness of white feminism to issues of coloniality and racial difference. And Sarah Worrell, another graduate of the Polytechnic, summed up her experience of Leeds to me in one word, misogyny, then added a few more, serious, vicious, rampant misogyny. This was at a time when art college staff rooms were full, if not exclusively so, of men, many of whom were unreconstructed and practiced sexual harassment of female students as a matter of course. Worrell, along with other women, went on to work as part of the feminist photography collective Pavilion in Leeds in the 80s as a way of resisting and countering the sexist values she encountered in the city and its institutions. All of these instances turn on moments of disillusionment, a disillusionment with radical, feminist, or otherwise supposedly progressive forms of pedagogy and discourse. All of these are subject to lengthy treatment in other chapters of my book. They also appear of a piece with White's account of the galvanizing importance of disillusionment with which we began. But the point I want them to make here, finally, and which my reference to the National Student Survey, the NSS, should clue you into, is that neither Gartside's, Biswas's, nor Worrell's dissatisfaction was containable or indeed exhausted within the banal circuits and metrics of consumer complaint. Their rage, their critiques, their autonomous actions were world-making. Often realized through collective agency, such worlds continue to reverberate in the present, shaping our own. Thank you very much.
Gavin, thank you so much. Saul, thank you so much. Thank you so much. I've never done one of these votes of thanks before. So it's the first one. There was so much in that. I've only got 5 minutes. I've got so much to say, but I can't say it all. Partly so much of what Gavin was talking about was my own sort of personal history. I'm slightly older than Gavin. So it was amazing to see artists up there that I'm still working with today. Claire McDonald is a very kind of close collaborator. And also just to see all the kind of bands that I kind of grew up listening to. So much of what Gavin sort of was saying was really music to my ears. My career, and I use the word very, very loosely, began in sort of post-punk music. And I first got involved in performance art and then live art because, like punk, it was this sort of bringing together of sort of art, politics, fashion in all kinds of ways. It was kind of giving permission to do things differently. I've sort of spent most of my practice sort of brokering relationships between sort of underground and popular and mainstream and traditional cultures, looking at those kind of relationships. And increasingly I've sort of been engaged with more and more to do with sort of archives and history, sort of looking back. But of course Gavin's beautiful lecture was not just a validation of my own career. It was a validation of sort of so much more. And I think some of the things I just wanted to sort of pick up on is this, I mean, Gavin's sort of beautiful use of the word, the term, not necessarily your term, but this sort of search for form, which I think is sort of so important. This idea of an attempt to sort of articulate or express this idea of disillusionment, to look at different kinds of strategies of sort of cultural resistance, and to sort of break away from sort of old world orders and to begin to create new world orders, sort of the opportunity for students to be able to sort of work across all kinds of forms, to be able to work in music, to be able to work in film, to be able to work in theatre, but then more importantly to see performance, to see the idea of sort of liveness as a space in which all kinds of ideas could be sort of cultivated and could sort of be expressed. So it's incredibly important to hear that. This idea of sort of relationships between illegitimate and legitimate practices as well, between kind of cultural values. There are sort of still, unfortunately, in the world, the great world of art, there are still these extraordinary sort of hierarchies between high art and low art. And the idea that sort of music and pop music is seen as a sort of less valid, less significant form. And I think if we'd sort of look at what was happening in the 70s, and particularly the sort of the research that Gavin's doing, we can sort of, that absolutely sort of bears testament to the fact that actually the sort of the way that artists sort of turn to music, the way that sort of people like John King turn to the Gang of Four, turn to the sort of music, the studio, the record, rather than turn to the gallery, it sort of represents that artists kind of felt that music was as legitimate an area as an area of practice and should be taken as seriously. And it was fantastic also to see the sort of Mary Harron writing in Melody Maker, the idea of sort of that Melody Maker and the NME with these spaces, you know, if you think about writers like Ian Penn and like sort of Paul Morley, that they were really cultural thinkers. What they're involved in was all kinds of critical discourses. They weren't just writing about pop music. They were writing about pop music as a sort of representative of a different way of sort of being and thinking, and kind of being in the world and seeing the world. And so this also kind of relates to me, so these kind of the legitimacy of contemporary practice as well, performance practice, and these relationships between the institution, between the underground, the relationships between the kind of work that's happening here at the Attenborough Centre and it's happening at the Marlborough in town, and how those kind of practices and how those kind of worlds collide. And all of these collisions were sort of coming out of Leeds in the 70s. And Gavin and I were sort of talking before about these incredibly significant cities. Liverpool, where I'm from, Glasgow, Manchester, Bristol to a certain extent, and Leeds, and how these were places where people sort of went to study, but there was also people who were from those cities, and how all those kind of, again, how those kind of worlds collided. And they became sort of crucibles where new ideas and new approaches could be tested, could be experimented, could be tried out, and that actually went on to change the world. And I don't sort of mean that. I'm not being sort of hyperbolic when I say went on to change the world. Really went on to change the world. what happened in the 70s and the 80s in Leeds, and the ways that Gavin described, really influenced how art could be thought about, how art could be made, who could be making it, who they could be making it for, where it could be located. And so the groups that Gavin was talking about, the sort of the Gang of Fours and the Mekons, they really sort of influenced the popular culture that we see now. Everybody says about the Sex Pistols, you know, that only 20 people went to a Sex Pistols gig, but every single one of them went and formed a band and changed the world. And that's so true of what was going on in Leeds. Impact theatre. The significance of impact theatre cannot be overestimated. They completely sort of exploded how we think about theatre. And they, everybody from impact theatre went on and did their own things in television, in music, in theatre. But they also influenced Forced Entertainment. Forced Entertainment wouldn't be here today without impact theatre. And Forced Entertainment have themselves influenced a whole generation of theatre makers. But what's one of the things that's really interesting about Leeds and why Gavin's research is so important is because Liverpool, Manchester, Glasgow, we were talking about this before, they're cities that are absolutely aware of their sort of cultural heritage, and that's partly because people who were part of those scenes at the time stayed in those cities, and those kind of histories are absolutely sort of enshrined in the bones and the blood and the sort of the beating hearts of those cities. Liverpool absolutely, it's not just the Beatles that Liverpool celebrates, Liverpool also sort of celebrates Echo and the Bunnyman and everybody, and Frankie Goes to Hollywood and all of that. The same with Manchester. Manchester is, as we all know, it's incredibly proud of sort of Joy Division, everything that happened there. Leeds, forget it. I went to, Leeds is one of the cities that's bidding for European Capital of Culture, and I went to a sort of consultation day there this summer. And I kind of said, you do know that Leeds is where it all began, don't you? You do know that this is where sort of post-punk and experimental theatre and performance art in the UK began, don't you? Nobody in that room knew that. So they were bidding to be a European capital of culture without any sense of their own histories, really, and why Leeds is so important, not just now, but why Leeds is sort of, and how Leeds got to be the Leeds today. Is the Leeds was kind of formed and forged in the sort of Leeds of the 70s. So Gavin's research is phenomenally important in sort of rewriting those histories. And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm also interested now in performance histories, because it's about not just about looking back, it's about sort of understanding how we got to where we are now and where we might go from here. So the idea of sort of performance and punk music, post-punk music, being a way of articulating disillusionment, I think couldn't be more urgent than it is right now, and how the kind of different ways that artists of all persuasions can think about their responsibilities, their roles, and how they can sort of help us to sort of change the world for the better. So I just really want to finish by a huge thanks to Gavin for this brilliant lecture. I think it's also, for me, sort of symbolic that Gavin's working in an English, is professor in an English and drama department, but is coming from visual culture. And for me, that speaks volumes about Sussex, that you didn't recruit a Shakespearean scholar, that you recruited somebody who's coming from the edges of all kinds of practices. And also what that says about where drama and our understanding of drama is sort of at now. But I just want to thank Gavin for his lecture. I want to thank Gavin for being Gavin. I want to thank Gavin for being the most amazing collaborator. Saul mentioned in his introduction that Gavin and I collaborated on a project called Performance Matters a few years ago, which was looking at how performance matters through the matter of performance. And that was just an exhilarating collaboration, certainly for me. It was a beautiful partnership, and I think it was a fantastic project. I want to thank Gavin for his influence, his wider influence on how we think about art and how we write about art. And I want to thank Gavin for being such an inspiration, not just for scholars, but for artists and for the world alike. So Gavin, thank you very much.
Thank you.